We're back with Heather and Herman to continue our discussion in part two.
Just for the audience's benefit, just to understand what it means in action for journalists trying to deal with the complexities that they face, there are choices to be made in the heat of the moment in order to be able to give that perspective and to be faithful to the codes of conduct in producing the news. And in those choices, I mean, to what extent is there a self-censorship, particularly with respect to, like, in the case that we are now, to prevent sort of further violence and looting? Where do we draw the line here, and or is there a line? And how are different rights balanced out? You know, it's some pretty distressing imagery can be shown at times, you know, dead bodies and stuff. But we also know that some of those distressing imageries have been pivotal in a societal and even global understanding of a particular event in history. You know, pictures of a young girl fleeing a napalm attack in Vietnam come to mind. How does that work in the era that we're in, and particularly in this moment of civil unrest? How are decisions made?
So a lot of what you're talking about is talks to how we actually work. So yes, the journalists will be alone there, and perhaps with the photographer, but they use the sounding board of editors, who do bring other in raise those contexts as well, and that's the debates that we have. In the environment I'm working now, as I said, it's all remote, but we're on WhatsApp groups and we're on Google Meets groups where we talk about this stuff all the time. It's like, for example, we talked about the story about Durban. The reporter basically focused on white middle class Durban, and we're going to hold on a second. There's a lot happening in Phoenix, in Chatsworth, in Kwamashu, in Chesterville. We need to actually reflect, you know, what's going there, and you know, please let's go back and let's try and do that. Difficult when in an organization which doesn't have that many, it's only got one reporter in KwaZulu-Natal. But that sort of deeper context and the decision making does happen with feedback from editors who are working with the journalist. So it's not someone just sitting alone and, you know, it's like how are you doing? Have you thought about this? Have you, you know, considered this? This has appeared in that media. Can you actually interrogate that? And there's different layers of people who work within an organization. So yes, there's the news editor who the reporter is talking directly to, and then there's the people who are the sub editors and others who are fact checking the information. So there's different processes and filters that it goes through, so that it's not just even though you might be alone, they're making that decision. And
let me come in there. I think, you know, for me, what is important here is that, you know, that process, and one of the things that we teach at university is media ethics, you know, and so. I think that the process of media ethics is the development of a sort of that sort of moral imagination, but also of the inclination of journalists to see problems before they arise, right? So to try and sensitize people to say, well, this might be true, this might be fact checked, but the way that we are framing it might be, as you say, Kamara, incendiary. Or it might be it might be one-sided, or we might be setting up a binary between things. So I think I think part of the problem of disinformation as it becomes so imperative to do the fact checking, and it's taking so much time and effort and resources to do fact checking, that there's almost, again, it's another layer of work for journalists to do that again pushes those questions of ethical reflection and contextualization, you know, further on the back burner, because the urgency of having to fact check things. And of course, these things are related. I mean, you don't want, I mean, factually untrue journalism is equally unethical, but I think it's that process of reflection. And also, once you have reported, to go back and do that sort of second reflection on what you have done. I think that is vital. And again, it's often a question of resources. It's a question of, can journalists afford the time to have these? So, and it's wonderful to hear about this political cafe that there is referred to. But how many journalists can afford that? You know, and when we sometimes do ethics workshops with journalists, it's a real consideration whether those journalists can be taken out of the newsrooms to spend a day or two or three on a refresher course. But unfortunately, I think if you consider journalism to be a profession, you know, which is again a whole different debate. But if you look at the way that other professions are having to constantly go back and attend conferences and do this professional development, I think that is something that we would have to see. And in cases like these, I think this is, you know, these, when there's a crisis moment, now is not the time to go on a refresher course. Now is the time when you have to apply that what you've learned. And I think this is where the mettle is being tested.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, we know disinformation spreads far quicker than the truth. Or at least evidence-based, incredible information. So it almost appears that, you know, journalists are facing a very difficult challenge, you know. In a sense, they can't be playing catch-up all the time. There has to be a strategic, orientation which allows them to bring perspective where they're actually, in a sense, inoculating society against it instead of playing catch-up. So in that respect, you know, what's the future, you know, like where to from here for social media and for traditional media? Like what should stay the same and what should change and how, as our closing question?
I really wish that that the role of journalism in its many forms would be taken a bit more seriously, and especially considering what we're up against in terms of disinformation. And so I wish there would be more investment into journalism and into the training of journalists and into, you know, so that we don't have these situations where newsrooms can't spare journalists to go on a three-day ethics course, whereas lawyers can go on a two-week legal conference. I do think, you know what I mean, we've got to get to a level where the role is, you know, is considered as a vital part of our democracy. I'd like to see that in the future. And then that does talk to, it comes back to how, you know, how journalism is funded and supported and the business models of it. So maybe if the state values, I don't know, countries like France actually do support journalism, but not that the state should influence the journalism, but should understand the role that it plays, and then maybe, you know, there should be some sort of tax so that journalism can be supported. But I think we're in incredible danger of not having quality journalism playing the role that it needs to play, particularly in censure environments like this, when we have very small newsrooms with journalists overstretched, journalists not having the time to bounce ideas around and frame things differently, to consider different forms of framing, fact checking, verifying, etc., and digging deep and investigating. So I would like to see a future where journalists do have that ability to function as we should, and so that we can better serve society with quality information from different perspectives. And I think more effort needs to be put into innovating around how do we support that.
No, just to push you a bit on that, Heather, like in terms of the innovation of new models, we've seen this kind of experimental work with citizen journalism, you know, yielding some interesting results on the continent, like, you know, Map Kibera project and in Kenya, outside Nairobi. I mean, how do you see that unfolding?
Look, I'm one of the few journalists who are a fan of citizen journalism, and because I don't think that journalists will ever be able to do what, you know, an ordinary person, the masses of ordinary people on the ground with their cell phones can do. So I do think that that could be part of the future of journalism, but I do think journalists and editors need to get off their pedestal. And like, I mean, this is where, I mean, I don't know what Herman's view is on it, but my view is, you know, us professional journalists, some feel threatened by that, that their role's been taken away and it's been diffused by, you know, everyone being a journalist. But I do believe that there are, for example, I mean, this is what I did my thesis on. There, like I said, some lawyers, like Pierre de Vos, for example, people in the legal fraternity, who are actually pretty, like, they're better at journalists than sometimes than analyzing. And yes, welcome, open it up. Why, you know, some caregivers are better at healing than professional doctors. Let's just face facts. So I mean, that they're all in the healthcare services. It doesn't take away our role. I think it can add value to our role to have more primary sources of information. And so, yeah, as I said, not many of my colleagues agree with me on this, but I do think that we should actually welcome more. I think we'd have more, we have more accuracy, we have more diversity, we have more voices. We sit on top of a pedestal, you know, like judging and like, talking about good and evil, and this, you know, the world's not manichaeistic. It's not like that. It's much more diverse, and we've got to get down there. And one way we physically can't, because there's so few of us, is by relying on citizen journalists, ordinary people, given the tools to train more people, train them how to fact check, how to, you know, how to carve a narrative, talk to them about framing, etc. And the more, the better. I mean, and that will be a massive. If we have masses of people doing that, there'll be a great counterforce to this rubbish of fake news. Well, and
you're speaking straight to some of the work we're doing at CABC. There, we must pick up that conversation another time. We've got 5 minutes. I want to give it to Herman. Herman, you know, Heather's really problematized the question quite deeply for you. What's your educated response?
I'll just agree with Heather in saying that, you know, there's this there's a real danger that journalists can see themselves as some sort of professional elite that do the gatekeeping work, and that in fact might actually broaden the chasm between them and people, ordinary people, and that might lead to even more misunderstandings and even more of a lack of that sort of imagination that I spoke of earlier. So I think absolutely, there's an academic called Nico Carpentier who's inverted this idea of gatekeeping, which is the traditional way of thinking about journalism, to saying gate opening, and then saying that they're the gate openers, that they're the people that have to actually curate, open, bring voices into the conversation. And again, then, that's not to say that they are not just mere conduits. They are doing the framing, they're doing the shaping. And I think we also do have to recognize, and, you know, as a media critic, I often, you know, maybe I'm mistaken for not appreciating the role of, I mean, the real pressures that journalists are under. And I do understand that. I think that also in this era of disinformation, often journalists are the targets of attack and of harassment and of online abuse. And so, you know, I think that it cuts both ways, that chasm. And I think once you open it up, once you get more participation, when you broaden that community of people interpreting the world, I think you also build alliances. So what you do then is also getting more people on your side and helping you and supporting you. And that goes from the sort of moral support to the more economic and resource support, where people are actually helping you do your work. So I fully agree that journalists should not see this as a threat or as an attack on them, their role, to say that, well, let's open it up and get more voices and let's get more views. And certainly when we see something like this happening that speaks so directly, I mean, we're talking about the looting and the violence, and it speaks so directly to the vast inequalities in our society, the vast polarizations and the oceans of misunderstanding, you know, and I think that's the role of journalism, is to try and cross those oceans, to say, let's try and understand what's going on here. And understanding is not the same as justifying. It's not the same as saying, oh, let's just say this is all fine, you know, looting and violence is because we understand why it's happening, therefore we condone it. That's not what I'm saying. But I think that the role of journalism is also to make that, to help meaning making and help interpreting and help understanding. And the more voices that can participate in that process, I think the better.
Might it be fair to say, just before we close, that if the media don't change their model, they might find themselves becoming irrelevant to some degree because of the power of social media?
It's something I think about a lot. I think the media can be irrelevant if we're only speaking to each other and to a certain class, and often it's race as well, of people, and that we are not, and we're not open to the diversity of the people that we serve. I mean, to be very honest, I think other than the SABC, and in particular its radio, which reaches out to, I think, the greatest diversity of people. I mean, all the rest of us, including Daily Maverick, speak to an elite. And there's often by speaking to an elite, and I know from all the other places I've worked for, which also spoke to an elite, it's about, that's how we get advertising, because the elite are the ones with the money, and if they read us, and if we can show that they read us, and in terms of our readership figures, we show we have the wealthiest people reading us, that brings advertisers and brings sponsors and donors and investors to us. And it doesn't sit well with me. It's a conundrum for me. Because quite every media house that I've worked for, it is the underpinning business. As I said, the only outlet should be the public broadcaster, which reaches out and which serves everyone. Yes, like Daily Maverick does serve everyone. Because it's free online. Sometimes tone and who's writing and who, it attracts a particular audience. So it's not an easy question to answer. And as it's something that I deeply grapple with wherever I've worked. And because I really do believe that, that you'd have less ignorance if more debate and more understanding, and media would last longer if it actually was a bit more open to the society that it is meant to serve, as in the voices of society, as in people writing for the organization represented from that society, in opening up and being diverse in many more ways. And that's my belief, but I haven't yet worked for a place that I think, marries my belief yet.
Yeah, I think the danger here is that as these economic pressures intensify, one of the responses is to come up with innovative ways of, for instance, subscriber models, of membership models, and all of that. I understand why that is necessary. But I think the mistake that one shouldn't make then is to conflate one's market with the public, And I think that, in other words, saying that you're working in the public interest is something different from saying I'm working in for my market, for my audience. And I think that is the really important thing. If you look at the history of public journalism, and again, Heather, I want to come back to your work that you've done at the Herald. I mean, bringing people together and listening. What is the major issue in our country here? Is that of inequality, right? And inequality and polarization. That's something that, has been with us, and it's going to be with us for many years to come, unfortunately. And we see this play out at the moment. And so that is a challenge for me for journalism to remain relevant and to make a contribution, is to try and overcome that inequality and polarization in some way. And that can only be done, I think, if you say that, yes, this is my market, this is the people, these are the people that pay my bills, but I'm not only serving them, I'm serving the public. And that means that sometimes I have to also confront my market with perspectives and views and things that they might not want to hear. And I'm, you know, pandering to the market might be an economic, make short-term economic sense, but that's a certain way, I think, of narrowing your perspective to the point that you might become irrelevant. And I think that is why it's so important, again, to that imagination of broadening things out and bringing more people on board, why that is absolutely crucial.
Yeah. I can talk to what happened at the Herald, which was different. I mean, the Herald had a particular market, and they get the market that, you know, that paid the money. It's an old white PE newspaper, settler, British settler community. And I actually really, you know, said, we can't only serve these people with the news that we do and the information they were. And worked with Nelson Mandela University, Alan Zinn, who at the center, at CANRA, at Center for Advancement Against Racism and Building Democracy. And we went into communities willfully, went into like communities like New Brighton, and opened the space for people to talk about the issues that were deeply affecting them in PE, and listened and recorded and wrote about it. But also what started happening is that the people, the traditional market actually started coming to those events as well. So there was a bridge building there, an understanding of the issues that are happening there. But what I find now, so everyone's, we call it community dialogues, and that's what it was. It was not a money-making thing. For me, it was really about, what I find now is that as part of the model of getting funding for journalism is webinars and these, So they invite experts and they invite audiences. It's not the same thing. They're not listening to anyone. They're listening to the elites. It's elites on webinars talking to each other. There's no going into communities to, and that saddens me. It's not enough of that's happening. Not enough of that's happening at all anywhere anymore. It's part of the revenue stream now. A webinar is part of a revenue stream where Heather and her mum will be interviewed. But we're not going deep into community. We're opening up a gathering. I mean, members of the community, it was amazing, the kinds of questions, because we brought politicians and the people would question. And the level of debate for me was astounding. Because it's based from people's, you know, interviewing the DG for education, when Eastern Cape Education was like, you know, in a shambles. And here were ordinary parents filling up our community hall, and there we brought the, I mean, a journalist, we brought the DG to be questioned by them, by teachers, by principals, by ordinary parents. So we created a conversation. Whereas now it's a conversation of elites again. It's not, yeah, I feel that all the media houses are doing the conversation of elites now.
Yeah, and I mean, if the protests and conflicts like these are opportunities to exactly see how that plays out, right? So we see now in terms of referring to the looters, the word them, just pay attention to how the word them is being used and operationalized and what that is code for, right? So one perspective talking about them and the other talking about them, and it is this othering process that is going on all the time. It's never us as a country. I mean, not never, but it's seldom, you know, thinking about this is something that is affecting all of us, that is part of our, the fiber of this very problematic and highly unequal polarized society. And so sort of that, they're talking about them and othering. And if you talk about community protests, not the ones, the looting and the violence that we're seeing at the moment, but if you're looking at the community protests over the past decade and a half, often the reporting there was very much that, Heather, that you're referring to of an elite perspective. I think Stephen Friedman spoke about the view from the suburbs, you know, that we often get served up in print media. And a vivid illustration of this is when there's a community protest somewhere on the road, and you would hear on the radio saying, avoid the N2 to work today. because there's a barricade, people are burning tires. I'd rather take a different view, road to the work, and I hope you'll have a lovely day. Nobody goes and interviews them, find out what the protest is about. It's about whose perspective is this, is the person wanting to get to the office in the CBD, right? So, I mean, and that's another way of routinely, day after day, framing those protests as something that is done by them to us. And I think we have to absolutely get away from that othering, that binary view of this is, we're all in this together, you know, to use a cliche. And again, that doesn't mean that this is, we're condoning violence or looting or instigation and racism and all of this, but we have to understand this is a problem that is plaguing us as a society that has long historical roots and that we have to find a way of solving together, and that othering and typecasting and scapegoating is not going to really help us overcome those problems.
That's a great, great last contributions from you guys, because, you know, I teach a course on values-based leadership and for organizations. And one of the case studies I do with my class to make them really reflect deeply is on the Marikana massacre. And I often point out that the stories of those miners and their families were not represented in the media in the lead up to that massacre, and how different it might have been if their voices had been present in the public discourse that we saw. So I just want to thank you both for such an honest and in-depth kind of session.
The media is a critical part of the institutional architecture that produces a democracy. So it's a very relevant and topical discussion, particularly today, and I really hope it gives our listeners a bit more insight into the inner workings and challenges that the media faces in the new environment that we find ourselves in.
So thank you very much for making the time, and I really do hope our listeners get some benefit out of this conversation. Thank you both.